Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast that I do with Tom Uren, which is all about cybersecurity policy stuff. My name, of course, is Patrick Gray. So Tom, we're going to be walking through the newsletter that you wrote for us, the Seriously Risky Business newsletter that you wrote for us here at risky.biz HQ. If anyone's not subscribing to that newsletter, you really should. And you can find all of the relevant links at risky.biz/subscribe. But we're going to be talking through a few topics today. One of them is something that we covered a little bit on the main Risky Business podcast yesterday, but this is the new guidance that Lloyd's of London, the insurer, has given to its underwriters about what they should and should not cover when it comes to the old cybers. And, you know, it's probably worth us having a detailed discussion about this, because when this stuff was first announced, there was a lot of confusion out there about what it really meant, wasn't it?
Yeah, so what Lloyd's said is that you should exclude from insurance policies, and I'll quote here, state-based cyber attacks that significantly impair the ability of a state to function or that significantly impair the security capabilities of a state. So that's my first thought when I heard this news is, well, this is just kind of like the ongoing trend in the cyber insurance market, where people looking for insurance have to pay more and less gets covered. And it's just because ransomware claims are out of control and insurers aren't making any money. But then I thought about it a bit more, and the things that they're excluding are just so huge that they're, in fact, that there's just no way that you could insure them. And ultimately, the government, wherever this attack takes place, is going to be left carrying the can.
Yeah, now this is the interesting part you got to, which is that, like, it's not like the victims in this case will just not receive any assistance. It's just that the scale and magnitude of the sort of events they're saying they won't cover. Yeah, I mean, we're getting into government bailout territory, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I mean, significantly impair the ability of a state to function. That's kind of like on the brink of societal collapse.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the government's going to step in. So I spoke to a couple of experts on this, John Bateman at the Carnegie Institute and Daniel Woods, who researches cyber and risk insurance, and they basically agreed, yeah, at that scale, you know, insurance isn't going to help you that much anyway. Like,
When everybody's clubbing each other to death over the last glass of drinking water. You
know? Yeah, exactly. And so, well, first of all, you have to ask, does it mean that the government needs to step in and provide some sort of backstop? And that's happened in the case of terrorism insurance. So after 9/11, underwriters stopped insuring terrorism risk, and that flowed through up to the point where major building projects wouldn't go ahead because they didn't have terrorism insurance. And so at that point, the US government and other governments around the world stepped in and said, look, we'll insure these risks. We need it because if we don't, economic activity stops. A significant amount of economic activity stops. But it's really hard to see how, with these cyber exclusions, that would happen. Like, is anyone going to stop anything because they don't have insurance about the collapse of society because of some sort of significant cyber incident? That's just
no. I get what you mean. But the thing that you have to be careful of when you write something like that, and this is the thought that occurred to me when I was reading it, is like, just don't say that, Tom. Just don't say we can't imagine a scenario so bad that that this is going to turn into an issue that doesn't require a government backstop. But I did find that stuff very interesting, that, you know, the US government actually had to step in because the insurance market just was like, okay, we don't do, you know, buildings anymore, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the other thing John Bateman said to me was that this is really a signal from the insurance industry as to where the line is, that we're, you know, beyond this, we can't go. And so that really leaves the government alone. You know, this is your space. So what do you do about it? So it doesn't seem like a backstop is necessary because, you know, no one's going to stop economic activity, or at least I don't think anyone's going to stop economic activity doing stuff because they don't have that kind of insurance cover. But although I think it's unlikely, it's, you know, that kind of large scale cyber incident is definitely possible. So what does government do about it? So that made me think of the Colonial Pipeline incident, which isn't on the same, well, I don't think is on the same kind of scale that Lloyd's is talking about. but it's still an incident where the, in my view, the interests of the company didn't match the interests of the US government or its citizens. So in that particular case, the Colonial Pipeline shut down fuel supply because they thought that they wouldn't be able to bill customers. So this was a sort of financial decision of the company. Now, I think that from a US consumer point of view, and therefore from a US government point of view, it could well have been better if they'd kept pumping and perhaps the deal is that the government would reimburse them afterwards. That would have saved a whole lot of angst. And so to me, it seems like in a really big cyber disaster, there are possibly at least two, three, a couple of decisions where the government would like to know that a company's going to take them and perhaps change or influence that decision to get them to do something else. So to get them to assume some sort of risk for the company that's justified because of the benefit to society. And so the question is, how does the government learn about those decisions and how does the government like change them or influence them?
Mm. Well, I mean, you pointed out too that we've got a rule here in Australia under the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act that allows the government to, and this is a quote, and I love that you included it, direct an entity to do or refrain from doing a specified act or thing, which is basically under certain trigger conditions, the Australian government can just tell you, you have to do this or you have to not do this. And there is no way the United States is going to, you know, wind up with a regulation like that because it's just way too broad and reeks of socialism is probably how it would be opposed over there. But you do point out that the Defense Production Act is something that can be invoked in certain circumstances in the United States to direct companies to do, a certain act or thing in the case of a cyber catastrophe. We should also point out, too, that we've been talking about how this applies to, you know, acts of war and government actions from hostile states. But it does also apply to acts that are of a significant impact to a state that are conducted by just anyone, right? So we're just talking about really, really big incidents here. But as you point out, US might have some options under the Defense Production Act, but policymakers everywhere really need to have a look at what options they have under current legislation in a scenario like this.
Yeah. I think there's what you do, what you can do, but also how do you even find out that you need to do it? So I think that's an interesting question as well. So what I like about the insurance backstop arrangement is that it gives companies some knowledge that there's a place to call, someone to talk to that may be able to provide, air quotes, assistance or even direction that I don't think you get from just having the ability to compel companies by itself.
Yeah, so let's move on to the next thing we're talking about this week, which is Oracle, which is involved in a partnership with TikTok. TikTok's US user data is stored in Oracle data centers. Oracle is doing an audit of TikTok algorithms to make sure there's no filthy Chinese Communist Party influence on the way the algorithm is selecting content.
Yeah, so Oracle already runs data centers in Texas that TikTok uses to store US user data. And the idea is that one of the concerns is that the Chinese state is just hoovering off all the US user data. So the plan is to have Oracle-controlled data centers and also US-employed people to stop that data getting siphoned off. So that's sort of one concern is the US user data. The second concern is that TikTok can be used to have political influence. And this is really trying to address that second concern. And the idea is that Oracle looks at the algorithm, magically decides, maybe I'm being a bit skeptical here, but magically decides that it's all good and that it hasn't been manipulated. So all I think this does is push the can down the road in that many people are already skeptical that you can look at an algorithm and decide, you know what it's doing, depending upon how complex it is. So I think there's a certain element of doubt there. Secondly, Oracle only gets to audit the algorithm. It doesn't actually control it. And so it can only look after the fact and see what's gone on and see if it can find any undue influence. I kind of think that in these sorts of companies, both algorithms and data flows get so complex, it's really, really hard to put your hand on your heart and say, everything's all good. There's always some element of doubt.
Look, yeah, there's the whole issue on that of what we call machine learning observability, right?
Yeah, which is exactly.
after a certain amount of time that a machine learning model has been operating, and you know, a lot of TikTok's stuff would be machine learning based, right? A lot of what it promotes, that would be a machine learning based algorithm that selects things for promotion. You know, after those things have been running a certain time, you kind of lose insight into how they're making decisions. But that said, that's also something that might make human intervention kind of stick out a bit more. And I do understand that TikTok does use a lot of human moderators to try to boost certain trends, which also makes me wonder about the utility of auditing the algorithm. I mean, maybe if they're trying to audit what's being promoted, both by the algorithm and by moderators, that's a different thing. But I mean, have they specified that they're just really having a look to see what is being boosted, or are they talking specifically about stuff that's being boosted algorithmically?
Yeah, so this story is relatively early. So all it says is it was a scoop by Axios, and it says regular vetting and validation to ensure that outcomes are in line with expectations. And that the models have not been manipulated in any way. So that's a quote from a TikTok spokesperson. So yeah, 100% agree. Can we even tell what's going on? Who knows? So to me, it depends on what amount of detail they go into in reports. So perhaps they can say enough that will make people feel better. So
there is a PhD in even designing a measurement program for this, right? So I don't know how they're going to go with it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think even if they do a really good job, you'll always be able to have an element of doubt. I think when there's that doubt, it really depends on how the Chinese government behaves. So if it gets more and more bellicose and confrontational, I think the willingness of US lawmakers to put up with the risks that TikTok represents just diminishes, and then they'll get some rather harsh consequences. Yeah.
Now, look, I'm glad you wrote about this next one, because we didn't have time to talk about it in the regular weekly Risky Business show. But a fascinating story in the United States. It comes from the New York Times. A father's Google account was automatically nuked by Google's child sex abuse material controls. Right. So what happened is this guy took a picture of his child's genitals to send to his doctor because, I don't know, maybe there was some redness or some swelling, and they're like, okay, the doctor's like, take a photo and send it over. Now, what appears to have happened is that photo got automatically ingested into his like cloud backup, like Google Images or whatever. And of course, as soon as it got to the cloud, Google's automated tools said that is a picture of a child's genitals, and automatically just nuked his entire account. And he hasn't been able to get it back.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it was automatically so much as I believe there was some human review, but they said this looks like child sex abuse material.
In order for it to have made it to human review, it needed to have been flagged automatically in the first place. So, you know.
Yep. Yeah, so automatically flagged, human review. It was forwarded to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is kind of the clearinghouse for potential CSAM material. They forwarded it to the police, who got a warrant, looked at all these guys' photos, decided that he was innocent, hadn't committed a crime. And what was stunning about this story was that so much of this guy's digital life revolved around Google. He used Google as an internet provider. He lost his phone number. He lost his email address.
Yeah, because he was using a Google-supplied phone number.
Yeah, exactly. And so by the time the police cleared him, which is, of course, some months later because, you know, these things take time, they couldn't get in touch with him because he didn't have his phone number, didn't have an email address. I think maybe they mailed him, like, you know, snail mail.
But, I mean, this is just such a Black Mirror-esque thing. And, honestly, they got a warrant based on this? The police actually got a warrant?
Yes. Yeah. Jeez. So they... Google provided his digital life to the police.
So they got a warrant to inspect the contents of his Google account, but they didn't have a warrant for like his personal devices or anything like that. They didn't kick in his door and put his phone in a bag. Okay,
no.
Right.
No. So the only thing he learned about it was, when he eventually did learn that they had tried to contact him, He realized that he'd been investigated by police. So he tried to contact Google and say, oh, this is all an innocent mistake. I was talking to my doctor or pediatrician or whatever. But he just kind of got no traction. Even after he went back, after the police had cleared him, Google still didn't reinstate his account.
Now, you and I were talking, excuse me, before we were recording, and I said, well, you know, clearly that's not a terms of service violation. You said, well, it still could be, right? Like, you can have a terms of service that said you don't post, you know, private parts of children, regardless of whether it's for a medical purpose or whatever. You could just have that blanket rule, and, you know, you can TOS, you know, bin someone just for what he did, which seems nuts, to be honest.
But you can also
understand why the tech companies would do that.
Yeah. So one of the steps I didn't mention is that he sent a photo to his wife, which 100% makes sense in the context of a family trying to get medical care for their child, but I think is probably still very likely a terms of service violation. But I think this is a case where terms of service doesn't reflect how people use services in real life. If your doctor says, send me a photo, after reading this story, I'm not going to do it, but prior to reading this story, I would have gone, yeah, of course, the doctor knows what they're talking about. This is a practical way, especially given COVID and the pandemic. I just think banning someone forever for that doesn't reflect how the average person would expect to be able to use these services.
Yeah, and the fact that it triggered a warrant is just, you know, kind of a bit crazy as well, in my view. Like, you could see how that would happen.
Yeah.
But clearly, I mean, it should have been clear maybe from the first thing. But I guess without the context, without asking the guy, you don't know why he's taken such a photo.
Yeah, so, exactly. So the
and that's why this one's interesting to talk about, because it's a dilemma, right? You can sort of sit there going back and forth for a while, but you can't really arrive anywhere firm quickly.
Yeah. The reporter who wrote the story, she said she looked at the photos, she saw the photos, and she can 100% see why someone would flag them as potentially child sex abuse. Mm. So without the context of knowing that there's a doctor, you're trying to get medical care, like, you know, it's an entirely understandable situation. I found this story just like kind of disturbing on multiple levels.
Yeah. Now, look, we're going to close out this podcast by talking about something, a bit of an interesting topic for us. It's something that you've written about quite a few times in the newsletter, and that's these Chinese government rules about vulnerability disclosure. And the rule is basically, you know, that you have to report vulnerabilities to the Chinese government within a certain time period of having discovered them. What's interesting is, the Chinese government say these rules exist so that they can have insight into serious bugs early, because they have obviously, you know, security implications for the government, etc. Meanwhile, you've got other people, particularly in the United States, saying, no, these rules are all communist sneakery, and what they're trying to do is get early access to these vulnerabilities so that they can weaponize them and use them to target us and whatnot. So this is something that, as I say, you've written about before, but it's a topic that is in the news again at the moment, because Robert Silvers, who's a senior official at the Department of Homeland Security, was on a panel at Black Hat and was talking about this.
Yeah, so he basically warned about the scenario you just talked about. Early access allows the use by Chinese intelligence agencies. So there is some evidence for that, and some vulnerabilities that were reported were used to target, I think it was Uyghur.
Yeah, I remember it was iOS vulns. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you could call that particularly solid evidence, to be honest.
Yeah, there's a kind of... the vulnerability gets reported to the National Vulnerability Database, which is actually run by the Ministry of State Security. So there's a direct line you can draw. I think that's one element. I think the larger element is that the Chinese government really just wants to exert control over private sector hackers, know what they're doing, make sure that it can capture them, make sure that they're operating in the state's interest. So I think that's the main goal. And we've sort of talked about what's the point of complaining about it.
Well, that's what you've sought to address in this week's newsletter, is actually explaining why they're complaining about it. And funnily enough, it's not about trying to influence China.
Yeah. So I spoke to Adam Siegel, who's the Director of Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council of Foreign Relations. And he's He was like, I think it's really just about telling other countries what a good way to run a disclosure process is. So he was skeptical that we can make any impact upon laws in the PRC, which I agree with. I think there's many security researchers in Chinese companies who are trying to do what I would call the right thing. So they sort of believe in a global internet, perhaps still, and think that vulnerability disclosure, responsible disclosure is a good thing. So you can still talk to those people, but you've got no way to protect them from Chinese laws that can potentially punish them for not reporting to the Chinese state. So his overall assessment was like, you know, this is a genuine concern. We're really talking about it to try and develop, I guess, a global consensus on what the right way to do vulnerability disclosure is.
Well, the way I see it is it's a bit like the NSA's vulnerabilities equities process, but they're taking bugs from private individuals as well as government researchers, right? And, you know, that's the way they're going to do this. And I would also posit, Tom, that there would be people in the US government who would love to have similar rules in the United States, right? So I do find it funny when you've got these American officials clutching their pearls over this approach in China, when if you offered them the option to be able to do the same thing in the United States, they would jump at it in a heartbeat. Now, I'm not saying all American officials would like that, but certainly some of them. Like, I know that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it also reflects the way people believe what a state is about. So the sort of US view is that there's people who go and do things, and the state is kind of something separate that allows people to live their lives. Whereas the Chinese view is that the state is everything. And so it just makes 100% sense if you've got that view that you just harvest all the information that you can. And that includes, you know, new vulnerabilities.
All right. Well, Tom Uren, it's fascinating to chat to you, as always, about your work. People who want to check out Tom's writing can go to risky.biz/subscribe get on the Seriously Risky Business newsletter. You, of course, will be back tomorrow with another podcast with the Gruck, the Between Two Nerds series, as we've called it. What are you talking about with Gruck this week?
I thought we'd talk about cyber war and how much we hate the term, but what it actually means or doesn't mean.
See, only you guys can actually get away with doing a what is cyber war conversation, because a million people have had that conversation. It's usually boring, but I know yours is going to be interesting. So I'll look forward to hearing that, my friend. Great to chat to you, and I'll catch you soon.
Thanks, Pat. See ya.